has created so much sensation in our own day. As if the doctrines already mentioned were not wild enough, he joined the Rosicrucians as soon as they began to make a sensation in Europe, and succeeded in raising himself to high consideration among them. The fraternity, having been violently attacked by several German authors, and among others by Libavius, Flood volunteered a reply and published in 1616 his defense of the Rosicrucian philosophy, under the title of the Apologia Compendiaria Fraternitatem de Rosea Cruce Suspicionis et Infamiae Maculis Aspersam Abluens. This work immediately procured him great renown upon the continent, and he was henceforth looked upon as one of the high priests of the sect. Of so much importance was he considered that Kepler and Gassendi thought it necessary to refute him, and the latter wrote a complete examination of his doctrine. Mersenne also, the friend of Descartes, and who had defended that philosopher when accused of having joined the Rosicrucians, attacked Dr. Afflictibus, as he preferred to be called, and showed the absurdity of the Brothers of the Rose Cross in general, and of Dr. Afflictibus in particular. Afflictibus wrote a long reply, in which he called Mersenne an ignorant calumniator, and reiterated that alchemy was a profitable science, and the Rosicrucians worthy to be the regenerators of the world. This book was published at Frankfurt and was entitled Summum Bonum, Quod Est Magiae, Cabalae, Alchimiae, Fratrum, Rosiae Crucis Verorum, et Adversus Mersennium Columniatorum. Besides this, he wrote several other works upon alchemy, a second answer to Libavius upon the Rosicrucians, and many medical works. He died in London in 1637. After his time, there was some diminution of the sect in England. They excited but little attention, and made no effort to bring themselves into notice. Occasionally, some obscure and almost incomprehensible work made its appearance to show the world that the folly was not extinguished. Eugenius Philalethes, a noted alchemist, who has veiled his real name under this assumed one, translated The Fame and Confession of the Brethren of the Rosy Cross, which was published in London in 1652. A few years afterwards, another enthusiast, named John Haydon, wrote two works on the subject, the one entitled The Wise Man's Crown or the Glory of the Rosy Cross, and the other, The Holy Guide Leading the Way to Unite Art and Nature with the Rosy Cross Uncovered. Neither of these attracted much notice. A third book was somewhat more successful. It was called A New Method of Rosicrucian Physic by John Haydon, the Servant of God and the Secretary of Nature. A few extracts will show the ideas of the English Rosicrucians about this period. Its author was an attorney, practicing, to use his own words, at Westminster Hall all term times as long as he lived, and in the vacations devoting himself to alchemical and Rosicrucian meditation. In his preface, called by him an apologue for an epilogue, he enlightens the public upon the true history and tenets of his sect. Moses, Elias, and Ezekiel were, he says, the most ancient masters of the Rosicrucian philosophy. Those few then existing in England and the rest of Europe were as the eyes and ears of the great King of the universe, seeing and hearing all things, seraphically illuminated, companions of the holy company of unbodied souls and immortal angels, turning themselves, Proteus-like, into any shape, and having the power of working miracles. The most pious and abstracted brethren could slack the plague in cities, silence the violent winds and tempests, calm the rage of the sea and rivers, walk in the air, frustrate the malicious aspect of witches, cure all diseases, and turn all metals into gold. He had known in his time two famous brethren of the Rosy Cross, named Walford and Williams, who had worked miracles in his sight and taught him many excellent predictions of astrology and earthquakes. "I desired one of these to tell me," says he, "whether my complexion were capable of the society of my good genius. When I see you again," said he, which was when he pleased to come to me, for I knew not where to go to him, "I will tell you." When I saw him afterwards, he said, "You should pray to God, For a good and holy man can offer no greater or more acceptable service to God than the oblation of himself, his soul. He said also that the good genii were the benign eyes of God, running to and fro in the world, and with love and pity beholding the innocent endeavors of harmless and single-hearted men, ever ready to do them good and to help them. Haydon held devoutly true that dogma of the Rosicrucians, which said that neither eating nor drinking was necessary to men. He maintained that anyone might exist in the same manner as that singular people dwelling near the source of the Ganges, of whom mention was made in the travels of his namesake, Sir Christopher Haydon, who had no mouths and therefore could not eat, but lived by the breath of their nostrils, except when they took a far journey, and then they mended their diet with the smell of flowers. He said that in really pure air there was a fine foreign fatness, with which it was sprinkled by the sunbeams, and which was quite sufficient for the nourishment of the generality of mankind. Those who had enormous appetites he had no objection to see take animal food, since they could not do without it. But he obstinately insisted that there was no necessity why they should eat it. If they put a plaster of nicely cooked meat upon their epigastrium, it would be sufficient for the wants of the most robust and voracious. They would by that means let in no diseases, as they did at the broad and common gate, the mouth, as anyone might see by example of drink. For all the while a man sat in water, he was never athirst. He had known, he said, many Rosicrucians who, by applying wine in this manner, had fasted for years altogether. In fact, quoth Haydon, we may easily fast all our life, though it be 300 years, without any kind of meat, and so cut off all danger of disease. This sage philosopher further informed his wondering contemporaries that the chiefs of the doctrine always carried about with them to their place of meeting their symbol, called the RC, which was an ebony cross, flourished and decked with roses of gold, the cross typifying Christ's suffering upon the cross for our sins, and the roses of gold, the glory and beauty of his resurrection. This symbol was carried alternately to Mecca, Mount Calvary, Mount Sinai, Haran, and to three other places, which must have been in mid-air, called Kaskal, Apamia, and Sholato Verissa Kaunuk, where the Rosicrucian brethren met when they pleased, and made resolution of all their actions. They always took their pleasures in one of these places, where they resolved all questions of whatsoever had been done, was done, or should be done in the world, from the beginning to the end thereof. And these, he concludes, are the men called Rosicrucians. Towards the end of the 17th century, more rational ideas took possession of the sect, which still continued to boast of a few members. They appear to have considered that contentment was the true philosopher's stone, and to have abandoned the insane search for a mere phantom of the imagination. Addison, in The Spectator, gives an account of his conversation with a Rosicrucian, from which it may be inferred that the sect had grown wiser in their deeds, though in their talk they were as foolish as ever. I was once, says he, engaged in discourse with a Rosicrucian about the great secret. He talked of the secret as of a spirit which lived within an emerald, and converted everything that was near it to the highest perfection that it was capable of. It gives a luster, says he, to the sun, and water to the diamond. It irradiates every metal, and enriches lead with all the properties of gold. It heightens smoke into flame, flame into light, and light into glory. He further added that a single ray of it dissipates pain and care and melancholy from the person on whom it falls. In short, says he, its presence naturally changes every place into a kind of heaven. After he had gone on for some time in this unintelligible cant, I found that he jumbled natural and moral ideas together into the same discourse, and that his great secret was nothing else but content. Jacob Burman. It is now time to speak of Jacob Burman, who thought that he could discover the secret of the transmutation of metals in the Bible, and who invented a strange heterogeneous doctrine of mingled alchemy and religion, and founded upon it the sect of the Oreocrucians. He was born at Görlitz in Upper Lusatia in 1575, and followed till his 30th year the occupation of a shoemaker. In this obscurity he remained, with the character of a visionary and a man of unsettled mind, until the promulgation of the Rosicrucian philosophy in his part of Germany, toward the year 1607 or 1608. From that time he began to neglect his leather and buried his brain under the rubbish of metaphysics. The works of Paracelsus fell into his hands, and these, with the reveries of the Rosicrucians, so completely engrossed his attention that he abandoned his trade altogether, sinking at the same time from a state of comparative independence into poverty and destitution. But he was nothing daunted by the miseries and privations of the flesh. His mind was fixed upon the beings of another sphere, and in thought he was already the new apostle of the human race. In the year 1612, after a meditation of 4 years, he published his first work, entitled Aurora, or The Rising of the Sun, embodying the ridiculous notions of Paracelsus, and worse, confounding the confusion of that writer. The philosopher's stone might, he contended, be discovered by a diligent search of the Old and New Testaments, and more especially by the Apocalypse, which alone contained all the secrets of alchemy. He contended that the divine grace operated by the same rules and followed the same methods that the divine providence observed in the natural world, and that the minds of men were purged from their vices and corruptions in the very same manner that metals were purified from their dross, namely, by fire. Besides the sylphs, gnomes, undines, and salamanders, he acknowledged various ranks and orders of demons. He pretended to invisibility and absolute chastity. He also said that if it pleased him, he could abstain for years from meat and drink and all the necessities of the body. It is needless, however, to pursue his follies any further. He was reprimanded for writing this work by the magistrates of Görlitz, and commanded to leave the pen alone and stick to his wax, that his family might not become chargeable to the parish. He neglected this good advice and continued his studies, burning minerals and purifying metals one day and mystifying the word of God on the next. He afterwards wrote 3 other works as sublimely ridiculous as the first. The one was entitled Metallurgia, and has the slight merit of being the least obscure of his compositions. Another was called The Temporal Mirror of Eternity, and the last his Theosophy Revealed, full of allegories and metaphors, all strange and Giesen, devoid of sense and ordinary reason. Böhmen died in 1624, leaving behind him a considerable number of admiring disciples. Many of them became, during the 17th century, as distinguished for absurdity as their master, amongst whom may be mentioned Giftheil, Vendenhagen, John Jacob Zimmermann, and Abraham Frankenberg. Their heresy rendered them obnoxious to the Church of Rome, and many of them suffered long imprisonment and torture for their faith. One, named Kuhlmann, was burned alive at Moscow in 1684 on a charge of sorcery. Böhmen's works were translated into English and published many years afterwards by an enthusiast named William Law. Mormius. Peter Mormius, a notorious alchemist and contemporary of Böhmen, endeavored in 1630 to introduce the Rosicrucian philosophy into Holland. He applied to the States General to grant him a public audience that he might explain the tenets of the sect and disclose a plan for rendering Holland the happiest and richest country on the earth, by means of the philosopher's stone and the service of the elementary spirits. The States General wisely resolved to have nothing to do with him. He thereupon determined to shame them by printing his book, which he did at Leiden the same year. It was entitled The Book of the Most Hidden Secrets of Nature, and was divided into 3 parts, the first treating of perpetual motion, the second of the transmutation of metals, and the third of the universal medicine. He also published some German works upon the Rosicrucian philosophy at Frankfurt in 1617. Poetry and romance are deeply indebted to the Rosicrucians for many a graceful creation. The literature of England, France, and Germany contains hundreds of sweet fictions, whose machinery has been borrowed from their daydreams. The delicate Ariel of Shakespeare stands preeminent among the number, From the same source, Pope drew the airy tenets of Belinda's dressing room in his charming Rape of the Lock. And La Motte Fouquet, the beautiful and capricious water nymph Undine, around whom he has thrown more grace and loveliness, and for whose imaginary woes he has excited more sympathy than ever were bestowed on a supernatural being. Sir Walter Scott also endowed the White Lady of Avenel with many of the attributes of the Undines or water sprites. German romance and lyrical poetry teem with allusions to sylphs, gnomes, undines, and salamanders, and the French have not been behind in substituting them in works of fiction for the more cumbrous mythology of Greece and Rome. The sylphs, more especially, have been the favorites of the bards, and have become so familiar to the popular mind as to be, in a manner, confounded with that other race of ideal beings, the fairies, who can boast of an antiquity much more venerable in the annals of superstition. Having these obligations to the Rosicrucians, no lover of poetry can wish, however absurd they were, that such a sect of philosophers had never existed. Borri. Just at the time that Michael Meyer was making known to the world the existence of such a body as the Rosicrucians, there was born in Italy a man who was afterwards destined to become the most conspicuous member of the fraternity. The alchemic mania never called forth the ingenuity of a more consummate or more successful impostor than Joseph Francis Borri. He was born in 1616, according to some authorities, and in 1627, according to others, at Milan, where his father, the Signor Brandabori, practiced as a physician. At the age of 16, Joseph was sent to finish his education at the Jesuits' College in Rome, where he distinguished himself by his extraordinary memory. He learned everything to which he applied himself with the utmost ease. In the most voluminous works, no fact was too minute for his retention, and no study was so abstruse but that he could master it. But any advantages he might have derived from this facility were neutralized by his ungovernable passions and his love of turmoil and debauchery. He was involved in continual difficulty, as well with the heads of the college as with the police of Rome, and acquired so bad a character that years could not remove it. By the aid of his friends, he established himself as a physician in Rome, and also obtained some situation in the Pope's household. In one of his fits of studiousness, he grew enamored of alchemy and determined to devote his energies to the discovery of the philosopher's stone. Of unfortunate propensities, he had quite sufficient, besides this, to bring him to poverty. His pleasures were as expensive as his studies, and both were of a nature to destroy his health and ruin his fair fame. At the age of 37, he found that he could not live by the practice of medicine and began to look about for some other employment. He became, in 1653, private secretary to the Marquis di Miroli, the minister of the Archduke of Innsbruck at the court of Rome. He continued in this capacity for 2 years, leading, however, the same abandoned life as heretofore, frequenting the society of gamesters, debauchees, and loose women, involving himself in disgraceful street quarrels and alienating the patrons who were desirous to befriend him. All at once, a sudden change was observed in his conduct. The abandoned rake put on the outward sedateness of a philosopher. The scoffing sinner proclaimed that he had forsaken his evil ways and would live thenceforth a model of virtue. To his friends, this reformation was as pleasing as it was unexpected, and Borri gave obscure hints that it had been brought about by some miraculous manifestation of a superior power. He pretended that he held converse with beneficent spirits, that the secrets of God and nature were revealed to him, and that he had obtained possession of the philosopher's stone. Like his predecessor, Jakob Burman, he mixed up religious questions with his philosophical jargon and took measures for declaring himself the founder of a new sect. This, at Rome itself and in the very palace of the Pope, was a hazardous proceeding, and Borri just awoke to a sense of it in time to save himself from the dungeons of the castle of St. Angelo. He fled to Innsbruck, where he remained about a year, and then returned to his native city of Milan. The reputation of his great sanctity had gone before him, and he found many persons ready to attach themselves to his fortunes. All who were desirous of entering into the new communion took an oath of poverty and relinquished their possessions for the general good of the fraternity. Bori told them that he had received from the Archangel Michael a heavenly sword, upon the hilt of which were engraven the names of the seven celestial intelligences. "Whoever shall refuse," said he, "to enter into my new sheepfold, shall be destroyed by the papal armies, of whom God has predestined me to be the chief. To those who follow me, all joy shall be granted. I shall soon bring my chemical studies to a happy conclusion by the discovery of the Philosopher's Stone, and by this means we shall all have as much gold as we desire. I am assured of the aid of the angelic hosts, and more especially of the Archangel Michael's. When I began to walk in the way of the Spirit, I had a vision of the night, and was assured by an angelic voice that I should become a prophet. In sign of it I saw a palm tree, surrounded with all the glory of paradise. The angels come to me whenever I call and reveal to me all the secrets of the universe. The sylphs and elementary spirits obey me and fly to the uttermost ends of the world to serve me and those whom I delight to honor. By force of continually repeating such stories as these, Bori soon found himself at the head of a very considerable number of adherents. As he figures in these pages as an alchemist and not as a religious sectarian, it will be unnecessary to repeat the doctrines which he taught with regard to some of the dogmas of the Church of Rome, and which exposed him to the fierce resentment of the papal authority. They were to the full as ridiculous as his philosophical pretensions. As the number of his followers increased, he appears to have cherished the idea of becoming one day a new Muhammad, and of founding in his native city of Milan a monarchy and religion of which he should be the king and the prophet. He had taken measures in the year 1658 for seizing the guards at all the gates of that city, and formally declaring himself the monarch of the Milanese. Just as he thought the plan ripe for execution, it was discovered. 20 of his followers were arrested, and he himself managed with the utmost difficulty to escape to the neutral territory of Switzerland, where the papal displeasure could not reach him. The trial of his followers commenced forthwith, and the whole of them were sentenced to various terms of imprisonment. Bori's trial proceeded in his absence, and lasted for upwards of 2 years. He was condemned to death as a heretic and sorcerer in 1661, and was burned in effigy in Rome by the common hangman. Bori, in the meantime, lived quietly in Switzerland, indulging himself in railing at the Inquisition and its proceedings. He afterwards went to Strasbourg, intending to fix his residence in that town. He was received with great cordiality, as a man persecuted for his religious opinions, and withal a great alchemist. He found that sphere too narrow for his aspiring genius, and retired in the same year to the more wealthy city of Amsterdam. He there hired a magnificent house, established an equipage which eclipsed in brilliancy those of the richest merchants, and assumed the title of Excellency. Where he got the money to live in this expensive style was long a secret. The adepts in alchemy easily explained it after their fashion. Sensible people were of opinion that he had come by it in a less wonderful manner, for it was remembered that among his unfortunate disciples in Milan, there were many rich men who, in conformity with one of the fundamental rules of the sect, had given up all their earthly wealth into the hands of their founder. In whatever manner the money was obtained, Bori spent it in Holland with an unsparing hand, and was looked up to by the people with no little respect and veneration. He performed several able cures and increased his reputation so much that he was vaunted as a prodigy. He continued diligently the operations of alchemy, and was in daily expectation that he should succeed in turning the inferior metals into gold. This hope never abandoned him, even in the worst extremity of his fortunes, and in his prosperity it led him into the most foolish expenses. But he could not long continue to live so magnificently upon the funds he had brought from Italy, and the Philosopher's Stone, though it promised all for the wants of the morrow, never brought anything for the necessities of today. He was obliged in a few months to retrench by giving up his large house, his gilded coach and valuable blood horses, his liveried domestics and his luxurious entertainments. With this diminution of splendor came a diminution of renown. His cures did not appear so miraculous when he went out on foot to perform them, as they had seemed when His Excellency had driven to a poor man's door in his carriage with 6 horses. He sank from a prodigy into an ordinary man. His great friends showed him the cold shoulder, and his humble flatterers carried their incense to some other shrine. Bori now thought it high time to change his quarters. With this view, he borrowed money wherever he could get it, and succeeded in obtaining 200,000 florins from a merchant named Demer, to aid, as he said, in discovering the water of life. He also obtained 6 diamonds of great value, on pretense that he could remove the flaws from them without diminishing their weight. With this booty, he stole away secretly by night and proceeded to Hamburg. On his arrival in that city, he found the celebrated Christina, the ex-queen of Sweden. He procured an introduction to her and requested her patronage in his endeavor to discover the Philosopher's Stone. She gave him some encouragement, but Bori, fearing that the merchants of Amsterdam, who had connections in Hamburg, might expose his delinquencies if he remained in the latter city, passed over to Copenhagen and sought the protection of Frederick III, the King of Denmark. This prince was a firm believer in the transmutation of metals. Being in want of money, he readily listened to the plans of an adventurer who had both eloquence and ability to recommend him. He provided Bori with the means to make experiments and took a great interest in the progress of his operations. He expected every month to possess riches that would buy Peru, and when he was disappointed, accepted patiently the excuses of Bori, who, upon every failure, was always ready with some plausible explanation. He became in time much attached to him, and defended him from the jealous attacks of his courtiers and the indignation of those who were grieved to see their monarch the easy dupe of a charlatan. Bori endeavored by every means in his power to find aliment for this good opinion. His knowledge of medicine was useful to him in this respect, and often stood between him and disgrace. He lived 6 years in this manner at the court of Frederick, but that monarch dying in 1670, he was left without a protector. As he had made more enemies than friends in Copenhagen and had nothing to hope from the succeeding sovereign, he sought an asylum in another country. He went first to Saxony, but met so little encouragement and encountered so much danger from the emissaries of the Inquisition that he did not remain there many months. Anticipating nothing but persecution in every country that acknowledged the spiritual authority of the Pope, he appears to have taken the resolution to dwell in Turkey and turn Mussulman. On his arrival at the Hungarian frontier, on his way to Constantinople, he was arrested on suspicion of being concerned in the conspiracy of the Counts Nadasdi and Frangipani, which had just been discovered. In vain he protested his innocence and divulged his real name and profession. He was detained in prison, and a letter dispatched to the Emperor Leopold to know what should be done with him. The star of his fortunes was on the decline. The letter reached Leopold at an unlucky moment. The Pope's nuncio was closeted with His Majesty, and he no sooner heard the name of Joseph Francis Bori than he demanded him as a prisoner of the Holy See. The request was complied with, and Bori, closely manacled, was sent under an escort of soldiers to the prison of the Inquisition at Rome. He was too much of an impostor to be deeply tinged with fanaticism, and was not unwilling to make a public recantation of his heresies, if he could thereby save his life. When the proposition was made to him, he accepted it with eagerness. His punishment was to be commuted into the hardly less severe one of perpetual imprisonment. But he was too happy to escape the clutch of the executioner at any price, and he made the amende honorable in the face of the assembled multitudes of Rome on the 27th of October 1672. He was then transferred to the prisons of the Castle of St. Angelo, where he remained till his death, 23 years afterwards. It is said that towards the close of his life, considerable indulgence was granted him, that he was allowed to have a laboratory and to cheer the solitude of his dungeon by searching for the Philosopher's Stone. Queen Christina, during her residence at Rome, frequently visited the old man to converse with him upon chemistry and the doctrines of the Rosicrucians. She even obtained permission that he should leave his prison occasionally for a day or two and reside in her palace, she being responsible for his return to captivity. She encouraged him to search for the great secret of the alchemists and provided him with money for the purpose. It may well be supposed that Bori benefited most by this acquaintance and that Christina got nothing but experience. It is not sure that she gained even that, for until her dying day she was convinced of the possibility of finding the Philosopher's Stone, and ready to assist any adventurer either zealous or impudent enough to pretend to it. After Bori had been about 11 years in confinement, a small volume was published at Cologne, entitled The Key of the Cabinet of the Chevalier Joseph Francis Bori, in which are contained many curious letters upon chemistry and other sciences, written by him together with a memoir of his life. This book contained a complete exposition of the Rosicrucian philosophy and afforded materials to the Abbé de Villars for his interesting Count de Gabalis, which excited so much attention at the close of the 17th century. Bori lingered in the prison of St. Angelo till 1695. When he died in his 80th year. Besides the Key of the Cabinet, written originally in Copenhagen in 1666 for the edification of King Frederick III, he published a work upon alchemy and the secret sciences, under the title of The Mission of Romulus to the Romans. Inferior alchemists of the 17th century. Besides the pretenders to the Philosopher's Stone, whose lives have been already narrated, this and the preceding century produced a great number of writers, who inundated literature with their books upon the subject. In fact, most of the learned men of that age had some faith in it. Van Helmont, Borrichius, Kircher, Boerhaave, and a score of others, though not professed alchemists, were fond of the science and countenanced its professors. Helvetius, the grandfather of the celebrated philosopher of the same name, asserts that he saw an inferior metal turned into gold by a stranger at The Hague in 1666. He says that sitting one day in his study, a man who was dressed as a respectable burgher of North Holland, and very modest and simple in his appearance, called upon him with the intention of dispelling his doubts relative to the Philosopher's Stone. He asked Helvetius if he thought he should know that rare gem if he saw it, to which Helvetius replied that he certainly should not. The burgher immediately drew from his pocket a small ivory box containing 3 pieces of metal, of the color of brimstone and extremely heavy, and assured Helvetius that of them he could make as much as 20 tons of gold. Helvetius informs us that he examined them very attentively, and seeing that they were very brittle, he took the opportunity to scrape off a small portion with his thumbnail. He then returned them to the stranger with an entreaty that he should perform the process of transmutation before him. The stranger replied that he was not allowed to do so and went away. After his departure, Helvetius procured a crucible and a portion of lead, into which, when in a state of fusion, he threw the stolen grain from the Philosopher's Stone. He was disappointed to find that the grain evaporated altogether, leaving the lead in its original state. Some weeks afterwards, when he had almost forgotten the subject, he received another visit from the stranger. He again entreated him to explain the processes by which he pretended to transmute lead. The stranger at last consented, and informed him that 1 grain was sufficient, but that it was necessary to envelop it in a ball of wax before throwing it on the molten metal. Otherwise, its extreme volatility would cause it to go off in vapor. They tried the experiment and succeeded to their heart's content. Helvetius repeated the experiment alone and converted 6 ounces of lead into very pure gold. The fame of this event spread all over The Hague, and all the notable persons of the town flocked to the study of Helvetius to convince themselves of the fact. Helvetius performed the experiment again in the presence of the Prince of Orange, and several times afterwards, until he exhausted the whole of the powder he had received from the stranger, from whom it is necessary to state he never received another visit, nor did he ever discover his name or condition. In the following year, Helvetius published his Golden Calf, in which he detailed the above circumstances. About the same time, the celebrated Father Kircher published his Subterranean World, in which he called the alchemists a congregation of knaves and impostors, and their science a delusion. He admitted that he had himself been a diligent laborer in the field, and had only come to this conclusion after mature consideration and repeated fruitless experiments. All the alchemists were in arms immediately to refute this formidable antagonist. One Solomon de Blauenstein was the first to grapple with him, and attempted to convict him of willful misrepresentation by recalling to his memory the transmutations by Sendivogius before the Emperor Frederick III and the Elector of Mayence, all performed within a recent period. Zwelfer and Glauber also entered into the dispute and attributed the enmity of Father Kircher to spite and jealousy against adepts who had been more successful than himself. It was also pretended that Gustavus Adolphus transmuted a quantity of quicksilver into pure gold. The learned Boricius relates that he saw coins which had been struck of this gold, and Longley de Frenois deposes to the same circumstance. In the Travels of Monconus, the story is told in the following manner. A merchant of Lübeck, who carried on but little trade but who knew how to change lead into very good gold, gave the king of Sweden a lingot which he had made, weighing at least 100 pounds. The king immediately caused it to be coined into ducats, and because he knew positively that its origin was such as had been stated to him, he had his own arms graven upon the one side and emblematical figures of Mercury and Venus on the other. I, continued Monconus, have one of these ducats in my possession, and was credibly informed that, after the death of the Lübeck merchant, who had never appeared very rich, a sum of no less than 1,700,000 crowns was found in his coffers. Such stories as these, confidently related by men high in station, tended to keep up the infatuation of the alchemists in every country of Europe. It is astonishing to see the number of works which were written upon the subject during the 17th century alone, and the number of clever men who sacrificed themselves to the delusion. Gabriel de Castagne, a monk of the Order of St. Francis, attracted so much notice in the reign of Louis XIII that monarch secured him in his household and made him his grand almoner. He pretended to find the elixir of life, and Louis expected by his means to have enjoyed the crown for a century. Van Helmont also pretended to have once performed with success the process of transmuting quicksilver, and was in consequence invited by the Emperor Rudolf II to fix his residence at the court of Vienna. Glauber, the inventor of the salts which still bear his name, and who practiced as a physician at Amsterdam about the middle of the 17th century, established a public school in that city for the study of alchemy, and gave lectures himself upon the science. John Joachim Becker of Speyer acquired great reputation at the same period, and was convinced that much gold might be made out of flintstones by a peculiar process and the aid of that grand and incomprehensible substance, the philosopher's stone. He made a proposition to the Emperor Leopold of Austria to aid him in these experiments, but the hope of success was too remote, and the present expense too great to tempt that monarch, and he therefore gave Becker much of his praise, but none of his money. Becker afterwards tried the States General of Holland, but with no better success. With regard to the innumerable tricks by which impostors persuaded the world that they had succeeded in making gold, and of which so many stories were current about this period, a very satisfactory report was read by Monsieur Geoffroy the Elder at the sitting of the Royal Academy of Sciences at Paris, on the 15th of April, 1722, as it relates principally to the alchemic cheats of the 16th and 17th centuries, the following abridgment of it may not be out of place in this portion of our history. The instances of successful transmutation were so numerous and apparently so well authenticated that nothing short of so able an exposure as that of Monsieur Geoffroy could disabuse the public mind. The trick to which they oftenest had recourse was to use a double-bottomed crucible, the undersurface being of iron or copper, and the upper one of wax, painted to resemble the same metal. Between the two they placed as much gold or silver dust as was necessary for their purpose. Then they put in their lead, quicksilver, or other ingredients, and placed their pot upon the fire. Of course, when the experiment was concluded, they never failed to find a lump of gold at the bottom. The same result was produced in many other ways. Some of them used a hollow wand, filled with gold or silver dust, and stopped at the ends with wax or butter. With this, they stirred the boiling metal in their crucibles, taking care to accompany the operation with many ceremonies, to divert attention from the real purpose of the maneuver. They also drilled holes in lumps of lead, into which they poured molten gold, and carefully closed the aperture with the original metal. Sometimes they washed a piece of gold with quicksilver. When in this state, they found no difficulty in palming it off upon the uninitiated as an inferior metal, and very easily transmuted it into fine, sonorous gold again with the aid of a little aquafortis. Others imposed by means of nails, half iron and half gold or silver. They pretended that they really transmuted the precious half from iron by dipping it in a strong alcohol. Monsieur Geoffroy produced several of these nails to the Academy of Sciences and showed how nicely the two parts were soldered together. The golden or silver half was painted black to resemble iron, and the color immediately disappeared when the nail was dipped into aquafortis. A nail of this description was for a long time in the cabinet of the Grand Duke of Tuscany. Such also, said Monsieur Geoffroy, was the knife presented by a monk to Queen Elizabeth of England, the blade of which was half gold and half steel. Nothing at one time was more common than to see coins, half gold and half silver, which had been operated upon by alchemists for the same purposes of trickery. In fact, says Monsieur Geoffroy, in concluding his long report, there is every reason to believe that all the famous histories which have been handed down to us about the transmutation of metals into gold or silver, by means of the powder of projection or philosophical elixirs, are founded upon some successful deception of the kind above narrated. These pretended philosophers invariably disappeared after the first or second experiment, or their powders or elixirs have failed to produce their effect, either because attention being excited, they have found no opportunity to renew the trick without being discovered, or because they have not had sufficient gold dust for more than one trial. The disinterestedness of these would-be philosophers looked, at first sight, extremely imposing. Instances were not rare in which they generously abandoned all the profits of their transmutations, even the honor of the discovery. But this apparent disinterestedness was one of the most cunning of their maneuvers. It served to keep up the popular expectation. It seemed to show the possibility of discovering the philosopher's stone, and provided the means of future advantages, which they were never slow to lay hold of, such as entrances into royal households, maintenance at the public expense, and gifts from ambitious potentates, too greedy after the gold they so easily promised. It now only remains to trace the progress of the delusion from the commencement of the 18th century until the present day. It will be seen that, until a very recent period, there were but slight signs of a return to reason. Jean de Lisle. In the year 1705, there was much talk in France of a blacksmith named de Lisle, who had discovered the philosopher's stone and who went about the country turning lead into gold. He was a native of Provence, from which place his fame soon spread to the capital. His early life is involved in obscurity, but Longley Dufresnoy has industriously collected some particulars of his later career, which possess considerable interest. He was a man without any education, and had been servant in his youth to an alchemist, from whom he learned many of the tricks of the fraternity. The name of his master has never been discovered, but it is pretended that he rendered himself in some manner obnoxious to the government of Louis XIV, and was obliged in consequence to take refuge in Switzerland. De Lisle accompanied him as far as Savoy, and there, it is said, set upon him in a solitary mountain pass, and murdered and robbed him. He then disguised himself as a pilgrim and returned to France. At a lonely inn by the roadside, where he stopped for the night, he became acquainted with a woman named Alois. and so sudden a passion was enkindled betwixt them that she consented to leave all, follow him, and share his good or evil fortune wherever he went. They lived together for about 5 or 6 years in Provence, without exciting any attention, apparently possessed of a decent independence. At last, in 1706, it was given out that he was the possessor of the Philosopher's Stone, and people from far and near came flocking to his residence at the Château de la Palue at Silanay, near Bargemont, to witness the wealth he could make out of pumps and fire shovels. The following account of his operations is given in a letter addressed by Monsieur de Serizy, the prior of Châteauneuf, in the diocese of Riez, in Provence, to the vicar of Saint-Jacques-du-Haut-Pas, at Paris, and dated the 18th of November, 1706. "I have something to relate to you, my dear cousin, which will be interesting to you and your friends. The Philosopher's Stone, which so many persons have looked upon as a chimera, is at last found. It is a man named Delisle of the parish of Silanay, and residing within a quarter of a league of me, that has discovered this great secret. He turns lead into gold and iron into silver by merely heating these metals red hot and pouring upon them in that state some oil and powder he is possessed of, so that it would not be impossible for any man to make a million a day if he had sufficient of this wondrous mixture. Some of the pale gold which he had made in this manner he sent to the jewelers of Lyon to have their opinion on its quality. He also sold 20 pounds weight of it to a merchant of Digne, named Taxis. All the jewelers say they never saw such fine gold in their lives. He makes nails, part gold, part iron, and part silver. He promised to give me one of them, in a long conversation which I had with him the other day, by order of the Bishop of Senes, who saw his operations with his own eyes, and detailed all the circumstances to me. The Baron and Baroness de Rheinwald showed me a lingot of gold made out of pewter before their eyes by Monsieur de Lille. My brother-in-law, Sauveur, who has wasted 50 years of his life in this great study, brought me the other day a nail which he had seen changed into gold by Delisle, and fully convinced me that all his previous experiments were founded on an erroneous principle. This excellent workman received a short time ago a very kind letter from the superintendent of the royal household, which I read. He offered to use all his influence with the ministers to prevent any attempts upon his liberty, which has twice been attacked by the agents of government. It is believed that the oil he makes use of is gold or silver reduced to that state. He leaves it for a long time exposed to the rays of the sun. He told me that it generally took him 6 months to make all his preparations. I told him that apparently the king wanted to see him. He replied that he could not exercise his art in every place, as a certain climate and temperature were absolutely necessary to his success. The truth is that this man appears to have no ambition. He only keeps 2 horses and 2 men-servants. Besides, he loves his liberty, has no politeness, and speaks very bad French. But his judgment seems to be solid. He was formerly no more than a blacksmith, but excelled in that trade without having been taught it. All the great lords and seigneurs from far and near come to visit him, and pay such court to him that it seems more like idolatry than anything else. Happy would France be if this man would discover his secret to the king, to whom the superintendent has already sent some lingots. But the happiness is too great to be hoped for I fear that the workman and his secret will expire together. There is no doubt that this discovery will make a great noise in the kingdom, unless the character of the man which I have just depicted to you prevent it. At all events, posterity will hear of it." In another letter to the same person, dated the 27th of January, 1707, Monsieur de Serizy says, "My dear cousin, I spoke to you in my last letter of the famous alchemist of Provence, Monsieur de Lille. A good deal of that was only hearsay, but now I am enabled to speak from my own experience. I have in my possession a nail, half iron and half silver, which I made myself. That great and admirable workman also bestowed a still greater privilege upon me. He allowed me to turn a piece of lead which I had brought with me into pure gold by means of his wonderful oil and powder. All the country have their eyes upon this gentleman, Some deny loudly, others are incredulous, but those who have seen acknowledge the truth. I have read the passport that has been sent to him from court, with orders that he should present himself at Paris early in the spring. He told me that he would go willingly, and that it was himself who fixed the spring for his departure, as he wanted to collect his materials in order that immediately on his introduction to the king he might make an experiment worthy of his majesty by converting a large quantity of lead into the finest gold. I sincerely hope that he will not allow his secret to die with him, but that he will communicate it to the king. As I had the honor to dine with him on Thursday last, the 20th of this month, being seated at his side, I told him in a whisper that he could, if he liked, humble all the enemies of France. He did not deny it, but began to smile. In fact, this man is the miracle of art. Sometimes he employs the oil and powder mixed, sometimes the powder only, but in so small a quantity that when the lingot which I made was rubbed all over with it, it did not show at all. This soft-headed priest was by no means the only person in the neighborhood who lost his wits in hopes of the boundless wealth held out by this clever impostor. Another priest, named de Lyon, a chanter in the Cathedral of Grenoble, writing on the 30th of January 1707, says, "Monsieur Ménard, the curate of Montier, has written to me stating that there is a man about 35 years of age named de Lille, who turns lead and iron into gold and silver, and that this transmutation is so veritable and so true that the goldsmiths affirm that his gold and silver are the purest and finest they ever saw. For 5 years this man was looked upon as a madman or a cheat, but the public mind is now disabused with respect to him. He now resides with Monsieur de la Palue at the chateau of the same name. Monsieur de la Palue is not very easy in his circumstances, and wants money to portion his daughters, who have remained single till middle age, no man being willing to take them without a dowry. Monsieur de Lille has promised to make them the richest girls in the province before he goes to court, having been sent for by the king. He has asked for a little time before his departure, in order that he may collect powder enough to make several quintals of gold before the eyes of his majesty, to whom he intends to present them. The principal matter of his wonderful powder is composed of simples, principally the herbs Lunaria major and minor. There is a good deal of the first planted by him in the gardens of La Palue, and he gets the other from the mountains that stretch about 2 leagues from Montier. What I tell you now is not a mere story invented for your diversion. Monsieur Ménard can bring forward many witnesses to its truth. Among others, the Bishop of Senés, who saw these surprising operations performed, and Monsieur de Cerisy, whom you know well. De Lille transmutes his metals in public. He rubs the lead or iron with his powder and puts it over burning charcoal. In a short time it changes color. The lead becomes yellow and is found to be converted into excellent gold. The iron becomes white and is found to be pure silver. De Lille is altogether an illiterate person. Monsieur de Saint-Auban endeavored to teach him to read and write, but he profited very little by his lessons. He is unpolite, fantastic, and a dreamer, and acts by fits and starts. De Lille, it would appear, was afraid of venturing to Paris. He knew that his sleight of hand would be too narrowly watched in the royal presence, and upon some pretense or other, he delayed the journey for more than 2 years. Desmarets, the minister of finance to Louis XIV, thinking the philosopher dreaded foul play, twice sent him a safe conduct under the king's seal. But de Lille still refused. Upon this, Desmarets wrote to the Bishop of Senés for his real opinion as to these famous transmutations. The following was the answer of that prelate. Copy of a report addressed to Monsieur Desmarets, Comptroller General of the Finances to His Majesty Louis XIV, by the Bishop of Senés, dated March 1709. Sir, a 12-month ago, or a little more, I expressed to you my joy at hearing of your elevation to the ministry. I have now the honor to write you my opinion of the Sieur de Lille, who has been working at the transmutation of metals in my diocese. I have, during the last 2 years, spoken of him several times to the Count de Pontchartrain, because he asked me, But I have not written to you, sir, or to Monsieur de Chamillard, because you neither of you requested my opinion upon the subject. Now, however, that you have given me to understand that you wish to know my sentiments on the matter, I will unfold myself to you in all sincerity, for the interests of the king and the glory of your ministry. There are two things about the Sieur de Lille which, in my opinion, should be examined without prejudice. The one relates to his secret, the other to his person, that is to say, whether his transmutations are real and whether his conduct has been regular. As regards the secret of the philosopher's stone, I deemed it impossible for a long time, and for more than 3 years I was more mistrustful of the pretensions of this Sieur de Lille than of any other person. During this period I afforded him no countenance. I even aided a person who was highly recommended to me by an influential family of this province to prosecute de Lille for some offense or other which it was alleged he had committed. But this person, in his anger against him, having told me that he had himself been several times the bearer of gold and silver to the goldsmiths of Nice, Aix, and Avignon, which had been transmuted by de Lille from lead and iron, I began to waver a little in my opinions respecting him. I afterwards met de Lille at the house of one of my friends. To please me, the family asked de Lille to operate before me, to which he immediately consented. I offered him some iron nails, which he changed into silver in the chimney place before 6 or 7 credible witnesses. I took the nails thus transmuted and sent them by my almoner to Imbert, the jeweler of Aix, who, having subjected them to the necessary trial, returned them to me, saying they were very good silver. Still, however, I was not quite satisfied. Monsieur de Pontchartrain, having hinted to me 2 years previously that I should do a thing agreeable to His Majesty if I examined into this business of de Lille, I resolved to do so now. I therefore summoned the alchemist to come to see me at Castellan. He came, and I had him escorted by 8 or 10 vigilant men, to whom I had given notice to watch his hands strictly. Before all of us he changed 2 pieces of lead into gold and silver. I sent them both to Monsieur de Pontchartrain, and he afterwards informed me by a letter, now lying before me, that he had shown them to the most experienced goldsmiths of Paris, who unanimously pronounced them to be gold and silver of the very purest quality and without alloy. My former bad opinion of de Lille was now indeed shaken. It was much more so when he performed transmutation 5 or 6 times before me at Senés, and made me perform it myself before him without his putting his hand to anything. You have seen, sir, the letter of my nephew, the Père Bérard, of the Oratoire at Paris, on the experiment that he performed at Castellan, and the truth of which I hereby attest. Another nephew of mine, the Sieur Bouget, who was here 3 weeks ago, performed the same experiment in my presence, and will detail all the circumstances to you personally at Paris. 100 persons in my diocese have been witnesses of these things. I confess to you, sir, that after the testimony of so many spectators and so many goldsmiths, and after the repeatedly successful experiments that I saw performed, all my prejudices vanished. My reason was convinced by my eyes, and the phantoms of impossibility which I had conjured up were dissipated by the work of my own hand. It now only remains for me to speak to you on the subject of his person and conduct. 3 suspicions have been excited against him. The first, that he was implicated in some criminal proceeding at Sisteron, and that he falsified the coin of the realm. The second, that the king sent him 2 safe conducts without effect. And the third, that he still delays going to court to operate before the king. You may see, sir, that I do not hide or avoid anything. As regards the business at Sisteron, the Sieur de Lille has repeatedly assured me that there was nothing against him which could reasonably draw him within the pale of justice, and that he had never carried on any calling injurious to the king's service. It was true that 6 or 7 years ago he had been to Sisteron to gather herbs necessary for his powder, and that he had lodged at the house of one Pelouse, whom he thought an honest man. Pelouse was accused of clipping Louis d'Ors, and as he had lodged with him, he was suspected of being his accomplice. This mere suspicion, without any proof whatever, had caused him to be condemned for contumacy, a common case enough with judges, who always proceed with much rigor against those who are absent. During my own sojourn at X, it was well known that a man named André Alois had spread about reports injurious to the character of Delisle, because he hoped thereby to avoid paying him a sum of 40 louis that he owed him. But permit me, sir, to go further, and to add that even if there were well-informed suspicions against Delisle, we should look with some little indulgence on the faults of a man who possesses a secret so useful to the state. As regards the two safe conducts sent him by the king, I think I can answer certainly that it was through no fault of his that he paid so little attention to them. His year, strictly speaking, consists only of the 4 summer months, and when by any means he is prevented from making the proper use of them, he loses a whole year. Thus the safe conduct became useless by the eruption of the Duke of Savoy in 1707, and the second had hardly been obtained at the end of June 1708, when the said Delisle was insulted by a party of armed men pretending to act under the authority of the Comte de Grignon, to whom he wrote several letters of complaint, without receiving any answer, or promise that his safety would be attended to. What I have now told you, sir, removes the third objection, and is the reason why, at the present time, he cannot go to Paris to the king, in fulfillment of his promises made 2 years ago. 2 or even 3 summers have been lost to him, owing to the continual inquietude which he has labored under. He has, in consequence, been unable to work, and has not collected a sufficient quantity of his oil and powder, or brought what he has got to the necessary degree of perfection. For this reason also he could not give the Sieur de Bourget the portion he promised him for your inspection. If the other day he changed some lead into gold with a few grains of his powder, they were assuredly all he had, for he told me that such was the fact long before he knew my nephew was coming. Even if he had preserved this small quantity to operate before the king, I am sure that on second thoughts he would never have adventured with so little, because the slightest obstacles in the metals, their being too hard or too soft, which is only discovered in operating, would have caused him to be looked upon as an impostor, if, in case his first powder had proved ineffectual, he had not been possessed of more to renew the experiment and surmount the difficulty. Permit me, sir, in conclusion, to repeat that such an artist as this should not be driven to the last extremity, nor forced to seek an asylum offered to him in other countries, but which he has despised as much from his own inclinations as from the advice I have given him. You risk nothing in giving him a little time, and in hurrying him you may lose a great deal. The genuineness of his gold can no longer be doubted after the testimony of so many jewelers of Aix, Lyon, and Paris in its favor. As it is not his fault that the previous safe conducts sent to him have been of no service, it will be necessary to send him another, for the success of which I will be answerable, if you will confide the matter to me and trust to my zeal for the service of His Majesty, to whom I pray you to communicate this letter, that I may be spared the just reproaches he might one day heap upon me if he remained ignorant of the facts I have now written to you. Assure him, if you please, that if you send me such a safe conduct, I will oblige the Sieur Delisle to depose with me such precious pledges of his fidelity as shall enable me to be responsible myself to the king. These are my sentiments, and I submit them to your superior knowledge, and have the honor to remain, with much respect, etc., John Bishop of Senés. To Monsieur Desmarais, Minister of State and Comptroller General of the Finances at Paris. That Delisle was no ordinary impostor, but a man of consummate cunning and address, is very evident from this letter. The bishop was fairly taken in by his clever legerdemain, and when once his first distrust was conquered, appeared as anxious to deceive himself as even Delisle could have wished. His faith was so abundant that he made the case of his protégé his own, and would not suffer the breath of suspicion to be directed against him. Both Louis and his minister appear to have been dazzled by the brilliant hopes he had excited, and a third pass or safe conduct was immediately sent to the alchemist, with a command from the king that he should forthwith present himself at Versailles, and make public trial of his oil and powder. But this did not suit the plans of Delisle. In the provinces he was regarded as a man of no small importance. The servile flattery that awaited him wherever he went was so grateful to his mind that he could not willingly relinquish it, and run upon certain detection at the court of the monarch. Upon one pretext or another he delayed his journey, notwithstanding the earnest solicitations of his good friend the bishop. The latter had given his word to the minister and pledged his honor that he would induce Delisle to go, and he began to be alarmed when he found he could not subdue the obstinacy of that individual. For more than 2 years he continued to remonstrate with him, and was always met by some excuse that there was not sufficient powder, or that it had not been long enough exposed to the rays of the sun. At last his patience was exhausted, and fearful that he might suffer in the royal estimation by longer delay, he wrote to the king for a lettre de cachet, in virtue of which the alchemist was seized at the castle of La Palue in the month of June 1711, and carried off to be imprisoned in the Bastille. The gendarmes were aware that their prisoner was supposed to be the lucky possessor of the philosopher's stone, and on the road they conspired to rob and murder him. One of them pretended to be touched with pity for the misfortunes of the philosopher, and offered to give him an opportunity of escape whenever he could divert the attention of his companions. Delisle was profuse in his thanks, little dreaming of the snare that was laid for him. His treacherous friend gave notice of the success of the stratagem so far, and it was agreed that Delisle should be allowed to struggle with and overthrow one of them while the rest were at some distance. They were then to pursue him and shoot him through the heart, and after robbing the corpse of the philosopher's stone, convey it to Paris in a cart and tell Monsieur Desmarets that the prisoner had attempted to escape and would have succeeded if they had not fired after him and shot him through the body. At a convenient place the scheme was executed. On a given signal from the friendly gendarme, Delisle fled, while another gendarme took aim and shot him through the thigh. Some peasants arriving at the instant, they were prevented from killing him as they intended, and he was transported to Paris, maimed and bleeding. He was thrown into a dungeon in the Bastille, and obstinately tore away the bandages which the surgeons applied to his wound. He never afterwards rose from his bed. The Bishop of Senés visited him in prison, and promised him his liberty if he would transmute a certain quantity of lead into gold before the king. The unhappy man had no longer the means of carrying on the deception. He had no gold, and no double-bottomed crucible or hollow wand to conceal it in, even if he had. He would not, however, confess that he was an impostor, but merely said he did not know how to make the powder of projection, but had received a quantity from an Italian philosopher and had used it all in his various transmutations in Provence. He lingered for 7 or 8 months in the Bastille, and died from the effects of his wound in the 41st year of his age. Albert Alois. This pretender to the philosopher's stone was the son, by a former husband, of the woman Alois, with whom Delisle became acquainted at the commencement of his career, in the cabaret by the roadside, and whom he afterwards married. Delisle performed the part of a father towards him, and thought he could show no stronger proof of his regard than by giving him the necessary instructions to carry on the deception which had raised himself to such a pitch of greatness. The young Alois was an apt scholar, and soon mastered all the jargon of the alchemists. He discoursed learnedly upon projections, cementations, sublimations, the elixir of life, and the universal alkahest, and on the death of Delisle gave out that the secret of that great adept had been communicated to him and to him only. His mother aided in the fraud, with the hope they might both fasten themselves, in the true alchemical fashion, upon some rich dupe, who would entertain them magnificently while the operation was in progress. The fate of Delisle was no inducement for them to stop in France. The Provençals, it is true, entertained as high an opinion as ever of his skill, and were well inclined to believe the tales of the young adept on whom his mantle had fallen, but the dungeons of the Bastille were yawning for their prey, and Alois and his mother decamped with all convenient expedition. They traveled about the continent for several years, sponging upon credulous rich men, and now and then performing successful transmutations by the aid of double-bottomed crucibles and the like. In the year 1726, Alois, without his mother, who appears to have died in the interval, was at Vienna, where he introduced himself to the Duc de Richelieu, at that time ambassador from the court of France. He completely deceived this nobleman. He turned lead into gold, apparently, on several occasions, and even made the ambassador himself turn an iron nail into a silver one. The Duke afterwards boasted to Longley Dufresnoy of his achievements as an alchemist, and regretted that he had not been able to discover the secret of the precious powder by which he performed them. Alois soon found that, although he might make a dupe of the Duke de Richelieu, he could not get any money from him. On the contrary, the Duke expected all his pokers and fire shovels to be made silver and all his pewter utensils gold, and thought the honor of his acquaintance was reward sufficient for a roturier, who could not want wealth since he possessed so invaluable a secret. Alois, seeing that so much was expected of him, bade adieu to his excellency and proceeded to Bohemia, accompanied by a pupil and by a young girl who had fallen in love with him in Vienna. Some noblemen in Bohemia received him kindly and entertained him at their houses for months at a time. It was his usual practice to pretend that he possessed only a few grains of his powder, with which he would operate in any house where he intended to fix his quarters for the season. He would make the proprietor the present of a piece of gold thus transmuted, and promise him millions, if he could only be provided with leisure to gather his Lunaria major and minor on their mountain tops, and board, lodging, and loose cash for himself, his wife, and his pupil in the interval. He exhausted in this manner the patience of some dozen of people when, thinking that there was less danger for him in France under the young King Louis XV than under his old and morose predecessor, he returned to Provence. On his arrival at Aix, he presented himself before Monsieur Lebray, the president of the province, a gentleman who was much attached to the pursuits of alchemy, and had great hopes of being himself able to find the philosopher's stone. Monsieur Lebray, contrary to his expectation, received him very coolly in consequence of some rumors that were spread abroad respecting him, and told him to call upon him on the morrow. Alois did not like the tone of the voice or the expression of the eye of the learned president, as that functionary looked down upon him. Suspecting that all was not right, he left Aix secretly the same evening and proceeded to Marseille. But the police were on the watch for him, and he had not been there 24 hours before he was arrested on a charge of coining and thrown into prison. As the proofs against him were too convincing to leave him much hope of an acquittal, he planned an escape from durance. It so happened that the jailer had a pretty daughter, and Alois soon discovered that she was tender-hearted. He endeavored to gain her in his favor and succeeded. The damsel, unaware that he was a married man, conceived and encouraged a passion for him, and generously provided him with the means of escape. After he had been nearly a year in prison, he succeeded in getting free, leaving the poor girl behind to learn that he was already married, and to lament in solitude that she had given her heart to an ungrateful vagabond. When he left Marseille, he had not a shoe to his foot or a decent garment to his back, but was provided with some money and clothes by his wife in a neighboring town. They then found their way to Brussels, and by dint of excessive impudence, brought themselves into notice. He took a house, fitted up a splendid laboratory, and gave out that he knew the secret of transmutation. In vain did Monsieur Purcell, the brother-in-law of Longley Dufresnoy, who resided in that city, expose his pretensions, and hold him up to contempt as an ignorant impostor. The world believed him not. They took the alchemist at his word and besieged his doors to see and wonder at the clever legerdemain by which he turned iron nails into gold and silver. A rich greffier paid him a large sum of money that he might be instructed in the art, and Alois gave him several lessons on the most common principles of chemistry. The greffier studied hard for a 12-month, and then discovered that his master was a quack. He demanded his money back again, but Alois was not inclined to give it him, and the affair was brought before the civil tribunal of the province. In the meantime, however, the greffier died suddenly, poisoned, according to the popular rumor, by his debtor to avoid repayment. So great an outcry arose in the city that Alois, who may have been innocent of the crime, was nevertheless afraid to remain and brave it. He withdrew secretly in the night and retired to Paris. Here all trace of him is lost. He was never heard of again. But Longley Dufresnoy conjectures that he ended his days in some obscure dungeon, into which he was cast for coining or other malpractices. The Count de Saint-Germain. This adventurer was of a higher grade than the last, and played a distinguished part at the court of Louis XV. He pretended to have discovered the elixir of life, by means of which he could make anyone live for centuries, and allowed it to be believed that his own age was upwards of 2,000 years. He entertained many of the opinions of the Rosicrucians, boasted of his intercourse with sylphs and salamanders, and of his power of drawing diamonds from the earth and pearls from the sea by the force of his incantations. He did not lay claim to the merit of having discovered the philosopher's stone, but devoted so much of his time to the operations of alchemy that it was very generally believed that if such a thing as a philosopher's stone had ever existed or could be called into existence, he was the man to succeed in finding it. It has never yet been discovered what was his real name or in what country he was born. Some believed, from the Jewish cast of his handsome countenance, that he was the Wandering Jew. Others asserted that he was the issue of an Arabian princess, and that his father was a salamander, while others, more reasonable, affirmed him to be the son of a Portuguese Jew established at Bordeaux. He first carried on his imposture in Germany, where he made considerable sums by selling an elixir to arrest the progress of old age. The Maréchal de Belle-Île purchased a dose of it, and was so captivated with the wit, learning, and good manners of the charlatan, and so convinced of the justice of his most preposterous pretensions, that he induced him to fix his residence in Paris. Under the Marshal's patronage, he first appeared in the gay circles of that capital. Everyone was delighted with the mysterious stranger, who at this period of his life appears to have been about 70 years of age, but did not look more than 45. His easy assurance imposed upon most people. His reading was extensive, and his memory extraordinarily tenacious of the slightest circumstances. His pretension to have lived for so many centuries naturally exposed him to some puzzling questions, as to the appearance, life, and conversation of the great men of former days, but he was never at a loss for an answer. Many who questioned him for the purpose of scoffing at him refrained in perplexity, quite bewildered by his presence of mind, his ready replies, and his astonishing accuracy on every point mentioned in history. To increase the mystery by which he was surrounded, he permitted no person to know how he lived. He dressed in a style of the greatest magnificence, sported valuable diamonds in his hat, on his fingers, and in his shoe buckles, and sometimes made the most costly presents to the ladies of the court. It was suspected by many that he was a spy in the pay of the English ministry, but there was never a tittle of evidence to support the charge. The king looked upon him with marked favor, and was often closeted with him for hours together, and would not suffer anybody to speak disparagingly of him. Voltaire constantly turned him into ridicule, and in one of his letters to the King of Prussia mentions him as un comte pour rire, and states that he pretended to have dined with the Holy Fathers at the Council of Trent. In the Memoirs of Madame du Houssay, chamberwoman to Madame du Pompadour, there are some amusing anecdotes of this personage. Very soon after his arrival in Paris, he had the entree of her dressing room, a favor only granted to the most powerful lords at the court of her royal lover. Madame was fond of conversing with him, and in her presence he thought fit to lower his pretensions very considerably, but he often allowed her to believe that he had lived 200 or 300 years at least. One day, says Madame du Houssay, Madame said to him in my presence, "What was the personal appearance of Francis I? He was a king I should have liked." "He was indeed very captivating," replied Saint-Germain, and he proceeded to describe his face and person as that of a man whom he had accurately observed. "It is a pity he was too ardent. I could have given him some good advice which would have saved him from all his misfortunes, but he would not have followed it. for it seems as if a fatality attended princes, forcing them to shut their ears to the wisest counsel. "Was his court very brilliant?" inquired Madame du Pompadour. "Very," replied the count, "but those of his grandsons surpassed it. In the time of Mary Stuart and Margaret of Valois, it was a land of enchantment, a temple sacred to pleasures of every kind." "Madame," said laughing, "you seem to have seen all this." "I have an excellent memory," said he, "and I have read the history of France with great care. I sometimes amuse myself not by making, but by letting it be believed that I lived in old times." "But you do not tell us your age," said Madame du Pompadour to him on another occasion, "and yet you pretend you are very old. The Countess de Gergy, who was, I believe, ambassadress at Vienna some 50 years ago, says she saw you there exactly the same as you now appear." "It is true, madame," replied Saint-Germain. "I knew Madame de Gergy many years ago." "But, according to her account, you must be more than 100 years old." "That is not impossible," he said, laughing, "but it is much more possible that the good lady is in her dotage." "You gave her an elixir, surprising for the effects it produced, for she says that during a length of time she only appeared to be 84, the age at which she took it. Why don't you give it to the king?" "Oh, madam," he exclaimed, "the physicians would have me broken on the wheel were I to think of drugging his majesty." When the world begins to believe extraordinary things of an individual, there is no telling where its extravagance will stop. People, when once they have taken the start, vie with each other who shall believe most. At this period, all Paris resounded with the wonderful adventures of the Count de Saint-Germain, and a company of waggish young men tried the following experiment upon its credulity. A clever mimic, who, on account of the amusement he afforded, was admitted into good society, was taken by them, dressed as the Count de Saint-Germain, into several houses on the Rue du Marais. He imitated the Count's peculiarities admirably, and found his auditors open-mouthed to believe any absurdity he chose to utter. No fiction was too monstrous for their all-devouring credulity. He spoke of the Savior of the world in terms of the greatest familiarity, said he had supped with him at the marriage in Canaan of Galilee, where the water was miraculously turned into wine. In fact, he said he was an intimate friend of his, and had often warned him to be less romantic and imprudent, or he would finish his career miserably. This infamous blasphemy, strange to say, found believers, and ere 3 days had elapsed it was currently reported that Saint-Germain was born soon after the deluge, and that he would never die. Saint-Germain himself was too much of a man of the world to assert anything so monstrous, but he took no pains to contradict the story. In all his conversations with persons of rank and education, he advanced his claims modestly, and as if by mere inadvertency, and seldom pretended to a longevity beyond 300 years, except when he found he was in company with persons who would believe anything. He often spoke of Henry VIII as if he had known him intimately, and of the Emperor Charles V as if that monarch had delighted in his society. He would describe conversations which took place with such an apparent truthfulness, and be so exceedingly minute and particular as to the dress and appearance of the individuals, and even the weather at the time and the furniture of the room, that 3 persons out of 4 were generally inclined to credit him. He had constant applications from rich old women for an elixir to make them young again, and it would appear gained large sums in this manner. To those whom he was pleased to call his friends, he said his mode of living and plan of diet were far superior to any elixir, and that anybody might attain a patriarchal age by refraining from drinking at meals and very sparingly at any other time. The Baron de Gleichen followed this system and took great quantities of senna leaves, expecting to live for 200 years. He died, however, at 73. The Duchess de Choiseul was desirous of following the same system, but the Duke, her husband, in much wrath, forbade her to follow any system prescribed by a man who had so equivocal a reputation as Monsieur de Saint-Germain. Madame du Houssay says she saw Saint-Germain and conversed with him several times. He appeared to her to be about 50 years of age, was of the middle size, and had fine expressive features. His dress was always simple, but displayed much taste. He usually wore diamond rings of great value, and his watch and snuff box were ornamented with a profusion of precious stones. One day at Madame du Pompadour's apartments, where the principal courtiers were assembled, Saint-Germain made his appearance in diamond knee and shoe buckles of so fine a water that Madame said she did not think the king had any equal to them. He was entreated to pass into the antechamber and undo them, which he did, and brought them to Madame for closer inspection. Monsieur de Gonton, who was present, said their value could not be less than 200,000 livres, or upwards of 8,000 pounds sterling. The Baron de Gleichen, in his memoirs, relates that the Count one day showed him so many diamonds that he thought he saw before him all the treasures of Aladdin's lamp, and adds that he had had great experience in precious stones, and was convinced that all those possessed by the Count were genuine. On another occasion, Saint-Germain showed Madame du Pompadour a small box containing topazes, emeralds, and diamonds worth 500,000 livres. He affected to despise all this wealth, to make the world more easily believe that he could, like the Rosicrucians, draw precious stones out of the earth by the magic of his song. He gave away a great number of these jewels to the ladies of the court, and Madame du Pompadour was so charmed with his generosity that she gave him a richly enameled snuff-box as a token of her regard, on the lid of which was beautifully painted a portrait of Socrates, or some other Greek sage, to whom she compared him. He was not only lavish to the mistresses, but to the maids. Madame du Haussay says, "The Count came to see Madame du Pompadour, who was very ill, and lay on the sofa. He showed her diamonds enough to furnish a king's treasury. Madame sent for me to see all those beautiful things. I looked at them with an air of the utmost astonishment, but I made signs to her that I thought them all false. The Count felt for something in a pocketbook about twice as large as a spectacle case, and at length drew out two or three little paper packets, which he unfolded, and exhibited a superb ruby. He threw on the table with a contemptuous air a little cross of green and white stones. I looked at it and said it was not to be despised. I then put it on and admired it greatly. The Count begged me to accept it. I refused. He urged me to take it. At length he pressed so warmly that Madame, seeing that it could not be worth more than 1,000 livres, made me a sign to accept it. I took the cross, much pleased with the Count's politeness." How the adventurer obtained his wealth remains a secret. He could not have made it all by the sale of his elixir vitae in Germany, though no doubt some portion of it was derived from that source. Voltaire positively says he was in the pay of foreign governments, and in his letter to the King of Prussia, dated the 5th of April, 1758, says that he was initiated in all the secrets of Choiseul, Kaunitz, and Pitt. Of what use could he be to any of those ministers, and to Choiseul especially, is a mystery of mysteries. There appears no doubt that he possessed the secret of removing spots from diamonds, and in all probability he gained considerable sums by buying at inferior prices, such as had flaws in them, and afterwards disposing of them at a profit of cent per cent. Madame du Haussay relates the following anecdote on this particular. "The king," says she, "ordered a middling-sized diamond which had a flaw in it to be brought to him. After having it weighed, his majesty said to the count, 'The value of this diamond as it is, and with the flaw in it, is 6,000 livres. Without the flaw, it would be worth at least 10,000. Will you undertake to make me a gainer of 4,000 livres? Saint-Germain examined it very attentively and said, "It is possible, it may be done. I will bring it to you again in a month." At the time appointed, the Count brought back the diamond without a spot and gave it to the king. It was wrapped in a cloth of amianthus, which he took off. The king had it weighed immediately and found it very little diminished. His Majesty then sent it to his jeweler by Monsieur de Gonton, without telling him of anything that had passed. The jeweler gave 9,600 livres for it. The king, however, sent for the diamond back again and said he would keep it as a curiosity. He could not overcome his surprise and said Monsieur de Saint-Germain must be worth millions, especially if he possessed the secret of making large diamonds out of small ones. The Count neither said that he could or could not, but positively asserted that he knew how to make pearls grow and give them the finest water. The king paid him great attention, and so did Madame du Pompadour. Monsieur Duquesnoy once said that Saint-Germain was a quack, but the king reprimanded him. In fact, His Majesty appears infatuated by him, and sometimes talks of him as if his descent were illustrious. Saint-Germain had a most amusing vagabond for a servant, to whom he would often appeal for corroboration when relating some wonderful event that happened centuries before. The fellow, who was not without ability,